Steve.
Hey, Emma.
What do you do when you really like something?
You know what I do, Emma? I talk to all my friends about it. What do you do?
That's a great idea, Steve. I even tell strangers on iTunes how much I rate and review it.
What a great idea.
And welcome to this month's edition of the Zeitgeist Tapes, where myself, Emma Burnell, a political journalist, and Professor Stephen Fielding from the University of Nottingham. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Emma. Hello, listener.
Discuss each month a particular piece of political pop culture. And what do we mean by that? We mean any piece of pop culture that has political references, that deals with political themes, that talks about either politicians or particularly weighty political subjects, but through the medium of popular culture. So this month, we thought we'd talk about one of the most political films of the 1980s. It deals with themes such as the oppression of the working class, the tensions within liberalism, women's rights and abortion. What else could I be talking about but, of course, Dirty Dancing? So, Steve, did you enjoy Dirty Dancing? I believe this was your first time of watching.
It was my first time, and it was only your insistence, because this was not my choice. This was definitely Emma's choice. And when she first suggested it, I thought, oh, yes, OK. She says there's stuff in it. And then the closer I got to it, the less I wanted to watch it. And it's kind of interesting why that might be. I've got to put my hand up. Because it's a very popular, you know, in inverted commas, woman's film. I now discover it's one of the most popular. It's women's Star Wars. Apparently, I've seen it quoted as described as on the internet, and I think that might have been at the origins of my deep reluctance to watch it. And you know, I'm really glad that I did. Now I'm really glad that that Emma kind of forced the issue and I watched it. First of all, I actually enjoyed it as a film. It was a very slightly cheesy kind of a film, taken at a certain level. It's got all the conventional attributes of a solid Hollywood film. There's various genres that it kind of references. It's a coming of age. There's story. It's about two star-crossed lovers from different backgrounds kind of making it in the end. And there's also nostalgia for a lost innocence or an apparent lost innocence. And it's got some really good music, very popular music, and some dance. And not being a great fan of dance, I was quite surprised by how I was sort of taken into it. So I kind of put my patriarchal prejudices to one side very, very quickly and was really glad that I was watching it. And also really grateful to watch a film that I would have completely dismissed as of no real significance, you know, just Hollywood bubblegum, because Emma said, no, it's got all these different themes in it. And they're there, and it's actually a really fascinating film.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I obviously have watched it, I think, possibly every year since I was about 10 years old.
Whoa.
I even went to the secret cinema where they actually did a whole Kellermans summer camp around it a couple of years ago with some friends. So, yeah, this is a film that's been a huge, huge part of my life. And as you say, it works on very, very different levels. There is very much that sort of Hollywood, I don't want to say ugly duckling story, but very much she is so gauche, bless her. At the beginning, and as she's learning to sort of become a woman through dance and through shagging, that is a lovely story for young teenage girls to watch. It's so positive about her as a sexual being. It's so filmed through her eyes. The entire film is about the female gaze. You have long, lingering shots on the body of Patrick Swayze and very little reciprocal shots to her. You know, this is a film for and by girls, and it's about the strength of girls' sexuality, about, you know, their empowerment, and different types of girls. So you've got the character of Penny, who has obviously been done wrong by a bad man, but who also comes through at the end and is very strong. And then the sister, who is a slightly comic character, but is given that moment at the end where she is, you know, supportive of baby's liberation. And finally, the mum, who has the best last line of a film. Yeah, I think she gets this from me.
Yeah, I think we might want to tell the listener what who may not be as engrossed in the film as you are, that it's set in the summer of 1963 at Kellerman's, which is for a British audience, it's a kind of very superior Brooklyn's where Jewish families, middle class Jewish families. Kind of retreat from the hot New York summer, go up to the Catskill Mountains, and then just play games. There's entertainment, you know, all the families get together, and it's that kind of a setup. And the two main characters, Baby Houseman, or Frances Baby Houseman, is the daughter of the doctor, you know, in a doctor's family, and she kind of has a relationship with Johnny Castle, who at least initially we see as bit of a bad boy, sort of classic bad boy, who is one of the dance instructors at the camp. And then from that, which is a very conventional kind of setup, it goes in the direction that Emma suggests in very interesting ways.
Absolutely. And I think it's vital to say, and in fact, the writer of the film, I was reading Hadley Freeman's excellent book about 80s movies last night. I was reading the Dirty Dancing portion of it. And, you know, she makes it very clear that one of the key early plot points is that Johnny Castle's dancing partner needs an abortion. And there are complications about where she can go and when. Abortion is illegal in 1963. They have found someone who is going to give her an illegal abortion. And in order for that to happen, Baby has to take her place in a dance that she would normally do at a different hotel. And that is the plot point that throws Baby and Johnny Castle together to spend a lot of time dancing and, you know, and therefore falling at least in love, if not in lust, if not in love. And the writer said that the film couldn't go on without the abortion was absolutely key to her, because if she'd just written it in as an incidental, it would have ended up on the cutting room floor. So it's a really important part of the plot that, you know, it's driving the plot throughout. It's what makes Baby fall out with her father, because she gets him involved when the abortion goes wrong. The doctor is then brought in to look after Penny. So absolutely, like a stick of rock written throughout this film is not Baby and Johnny's relationship, but Penny's abortion.
Mm. And it's really, it's sort of significant. I mean, it's released in 1987. I mean, but it was envisaged by the writer from at least 1980. And she had a very tough time getting the script accepted by a studio. And in fact, Wikipedia tells me it's produced by a very small studio and there were very low expectations for the film. It's explicitly thought of as a teen women, you know, young girls movie, and it just takes off. I mean, you know, to be one of the most popular, as I said right at the start, one of the most popular women's films ever. So probably, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I would suspect that the abortion issue was quite controversial, and that's probably why the bigger studios kind of backed off. But at the height of Reaganism, you know, this is kind of a remarkable set of subjects to be tackled for a mainstream Hollywood film, not an art house film, not a film directed by. I was just thinking that Ken Loach. Think of Ken Loach directing this film. Not a Ken Loach film. Not a film for Guardian readers or for readers of New York Times, but for ordinary in the main for younger women, but clearly a an audience that goes beyond them, but nonetheless, it has a particular resonance for that kind of an audience. And so, again, I return to my reluctance to watching it. That's probably why I didn't want to watch it. But that shows you my own prejudices about such films.
I think that's quite revolutionary in and of itself. A lot of films that are seen as boy films, from, say, Star Wars to The Godfather, are considered as good films in and of themselves. They are the important films. Whereas films that are made with a female gaze or a female audience in mind are just generally considered as a bit less important. And I think that's something that deserves challenging, and Dirty Dancing definitely challenges that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, in ways that I found really, really surprising. I can't say, you know, if I'd been a young teenage girl in the late 1980s and I'd watched Dirty Dancing as you were, Emma, what I would have got from it, politically, even politically from its widest sense, maybe like you were saying, the empowered character of Baby Frances Houseman. I mean, she is the powerful. This she is the powerful one. That was something that struck me. About halfway through the film, because Johnny Castle, you know, played by Patrick Swayze, I mean, you know, it got a bit tiresome the number of times he took his shirt off, frankly. But then again, I wasn't necessarily a target.
Oh, no, it didn't.
I know. I wasn't a target audience there. But you're absolutely right. You're meant to look at his body and go, ooh. But her body is not sexualized to the same extent, but he most definitely is. And also, he is the character in that relationship who doesn't have any of the power. He is the one that has self-doubt. He is because he's from a working class background. You know, the best that he can really aspire to is to be a house painter, you know, once the dancing days are over. And she's going to go. She's a doctor's daughter. She's going to go off work for the Peace Corps and everything. And when he is falsely accused of stealing somebody's money, she stands up for him and you know, at the very least stops the police being called in. But she stands up for him. She's the one that kind of saves the situation in the end. And it is quite interesting. He is the feminized, in inverted commas, figure in that relationship. He is the weak one. It's her. She's got the strength, actually, in the end, to make not only that relationship work, but then to pull everything together so there's this great happy ending, really, in the film.
And not even, yeah, and that's throughout. So even when they first get together physically, she is driving that all the way through. You know, she's the one who makes it explicit that she wants to have the relationship. He just stands there not knowing what to say. She's like, then dance with me. She is touching him. She reaches out to him all the way through. I can't imagine a teenage film doing that now. It just, you know, girls have been re-infantilized in terms of their sexuality in most movies now. And it's just, you know, again, and she's never punished for it. So many times throughout the history of film, girls are punished for wanting sex, for enjoying sex, and for having sex. And actually, all we see is her getting happier and happier and shinier and more confident. And he loses his job. And she has a row with her family, which I think we'll come to. But that is all resolved. Yeah, there are no bad consequences for Baby having great sex.
Mm. So you're absolutely right. I mean, and when the classic instance of the abortion, you know, unwanted pregnancy and abortion, although the character Penny who does get pregnant and it's a botched abortion and her baby's father comes in, kind of patches things up. She isn't punished for it either in the end, is she? She can survive that as well. I mean, she gets over it. She's back in amongst the dancers. So there is no classic punishment for any of the usual female transgressions, are there?
No, absolutely. The only person who is punished for the abortion is the appalling feckless bugger who knocks Penny up in the first place, who is not, as assumed by many of the characters, Patrick Swayze, but is in fact Robbie, the evil waiter.
Yeah, and so we've kind of, I mean, I don't know if we've dealt with all the gender issues, but like you said right at the start, we've got there's gender is very paramount, and it's very interesting and positive, purposeful sort of treatment of gender, and also almost a role reversal in terms of that relationship, which is, you know, for 1987, this, well, for today, like you're saying, we've maybe even taken a step back in terms of popular film. I don't know. But there's also an interesting political element, and Robbie, and also class element. And Robbie is kind of various things come together in that, because the thing about, I mean, I was just thinking rather grandly when I was watching it, this kind of holiday camp, what was it called? Kellerman's. It's America, isn't it? It's kind of America in the early 1960s. It's like a metaphor for America. There's quite a few metaphors that if you wanted to think about it in those terms, you can see them. So Kellerman's is kind of like America. I mean, they're all Jewish there, but it's just a kind of an accident, really, in many respects. So, but class is there, class relations are there, the hard reality of being a worker and of class difference is there. So in Kellerman's, class distinction is very, very, very obvious. There's the middle class guests who are paid to have a good time, and there are waiters, all white boys, and we'll maybe come to the race thing as well, maybe, because that's not dealt with at all. But there are all these white college-educated boys. But the waiters are kind of young college boys, or boys about to go to Harvard or wherever, and they're treated in one way, and they're allowed to have some kind of dalliances with the young female guests. But then there are the dancers and the other employees, the people that just do the food and whatever, and they are, you know, they're verboten. They kind of anything to do with the guests, and they're treated in a very harsh way. By Kellerman and his younger, I think, grandson, who treats them, you know, like dirt, and in a very harsh way, which is kind of interesting. And Johnny is one of those. He's not that, you know, it's almost like a sort of class apartheid, really, in that place. And that's quite surprising in a film, in an American film, because most American mainstream films don't deal with class. Some famously do, but most of them don't. And to see class, but Robbie, I mean, to get back to Robbie, because there was a point about 12, you know, 20 minutes ago, because Robbie is the kind of the bad guy. There aren't that many actual bad characters by the end of the film, but he is a bad guy. He's one of the waiters. He's going off to Harvard, or he's going off to a top-ranked medical school. He's going to be a doctor, like Baby's father is a doctor. But he's the one that gets Penny pregnant and refuses to have anything to do with her. After that, he doesn't pay for the abortion. Baby has to get that out of her father by lying to him. But when Baby goes to Robbie to ask him to pay for the abortion, because she doesn't know quite how bad a guy he is yet, he turns around and says, "No, I'm not doing anything about that." Because, and there's this great quote that he says, basically, you know, some people count and some people don't. And that could be taken as just, well, he's an arse. He's a nasty piece of work, just as a person. And then within a couple of seconds, he's sort of referring and actually asks her, do you want to borrow this book I've been reading? And it's Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. I mean, if you want to politicize a set of attitudes to women, to people, to society, that's what you do. I mean, it's not. I mean, I'm not sure how many members of the audience would have known who, you know, the author of The Fountainhead was, or what The Fountainhead represented. But today, we all know. Well, not we all know, but maybe our listener knows. And you know, it's something that you know, leading members of the cabinet are meant to read certain chapters every year. You know, it's the Fountainhead of neoliberalism, so far as some people are concerned. And there's this guy Robbie, the actual swine in all of this, who's reading it, and he really likes it. So that politicizes event, you know, the whole thing, which could have been just a communal garden, you know, kind of a story. There's quite a, you know, at least in the background, there's something there. And then the one other thing, which you know, Baby Houseman is actually called Frances. Because as part of her growing up, she stops being called Baby. You know, Johnny wants to know what her actual name is, and it's Frances. And as she says, I'm named after the first woman member of the cabinet. which I had to Google, by the way, which wasn't available in 1987. And it turns out it's Francis Perkins, who was Secretary of Labour, for goodness sake. I mean, how relevant is that to this film and its depiction of labour relations, who was FDR's Secretary of Labour in the 1930s, 1940s? So, you know, in the background, I mean, there's actually a hell of a lot of politics going on in terms of encouraging us to see the film in certain terms.
Absolutely. And how brilliant is it that this teenage film about dancing and shagging is just so unpatronising to its audience that it uses the Fountainhead as that shorthand for here's what this guy is and believes, and just expects its audience to be okay with that. I think that's, you know, that in itself is brilliant. In terms of the racial politics, it's ever so slightly there, and it's there in quite an interesting way, because apart from Robbie, who is just out and out evil right wing bastard, all of the other characters, whether they are all of the other rich characters, are liberal. They may not act like it a lot of the time, but they certainly see themselves as that way. There's a throwaway line where Neil, the son or the nephew of the guy who owns it, who's going to go and take over the business, says that at the end of the summer, he's going on a freedom ride. The freedom rides were, you know, where people from the north went down to the south to register voters and for civil rights purposes. So they were nodding again in that oblique way to this whole set of politics that these people had. Now, when I went to see, not, I say, through my own choice, Dirty Dancing on the stage, it was a hen night, don't judge me. Now, most of that, they took a lot of the politics out, but they had jammed in this really weird 10-minute section where, I kid you not, they all sang We Will Overcome, and then floating above their heads as if projected onto the sky in stars was Martin Luther King. And it was the tackiest, weirdest, did not belong in their thing. And it was just like, you've completely missed the point of the subtlety of the politics of the film. So there is racial politics in there, but only very obliquely.
Yeah, I mean, very, very obliquely, I have to say. That'd be one of the criticisms that I would make of the film. I mean, there's a few. I'm not just completely, you know, this is all wonderful. Because it, you know, I mean, I don't know how many, you know, black employees there would have been in a place like that. I don't really know. But, you know, when they go and depict all the employees dancing, first of all, it's, you know, when there's a cut. I was thinking, well, what's really going on here? Because it contrasts how the nice Jewish middle class people are doing the foxtrot, and it's all very stiff and it's all very formal, and there's no feeling in it. And yet, when Baby kind of stumbles upon all the employees in their own quarters dancing, and it's highly sexualized. I mean, it's almost like they're having sex but pretending they're dancing. You know, some of them. It's kind of smoky. It's sweaty. It's kind of atavistic, almost animalistic. I mean, I might be pushing this a little bit. I don't know.
No, I think that's absolutely but these true. Working they are basically getting to third base.
These are like a working class people, you know, and they're kind of their feelings. They've got all their feelings here, and dance is bringing it out. And it was, you know, it's a bit like how Thomas Hardy would depict kind of country folk, you know, at their festivals. I mean, there's a certain literary thing about working class people being closer to their, you know, sexualized beings. And I think, I don't really know what I think about this. It's kind of, it's trying to be liberal about things, but also it's depicting these people in a certain way. But within all of that, there was like one black couple who were dancing together. And yes, you're absolutely right. Kellerman's nephew does say that, and that's noteworthy in itself. But that's it. It's like there are one or two of the little references to events that are going on down south. But it's not about race. And maybe that's because that's, you know, Kellerman's would not be the real people. And it's kind of the autobiography to some extent of the writer. This is not what would have been said. But I did wonder about that, whether that was an opportunity missed or whether they deliberately downplayed that for whatever reason.
It is a reasonable criticism. It is a very, I think the summer camp would have been very white, but there could have been, that more could have been made of that, particularly given the contrast in the kind of music that they're listening to. There's a lot of very black music. That the working class, usually generally Catholic, I believe, kids. There's a lot of Catholic surnames in there. And I think that's something that Hadley Freeman brings out in her essay on this. I think there is, it more could be made. You've got the band leader who's black, it's not one of the core elements of the film or the politics of the film at all.
Yeah, I mean, and the black band leader is there really to humanise Kellerman, who, like you say, Kellerman, like his nephew, he's really harsh throughout most of the film to the employees. But there is, he clearly gets on with the black band leader and has done for many, many years, because he refers to them going all the way back to the Depression. So they share a history together. And his nephew, you know, like you say, he's doing what he's going to do. So that kind of takes an edge off them. But they're horrible. To the working class people, that is not diminished.
That again is one of the key aspects of the film, is that tension within middle class liberalism of, well, theoretically, I absolutely believe that we should be going out and doing this in a certain way, but in reality, I don't treat people like that. And that comes to a head, doesn't it, when Baby has admitted that she spent the night with Johnny Castle to her father in order to try and save Johnny's job. And her father basically ostracizes her. And Baby says to him, well, maybe we could hear now what it is that Baby's response to that is.
I'm sorry I lied to you. But you lied too. You told me everyone was alike and deserved a fair break. But you meant everyone who was like you. You told me you wanted me to change the world, make it better. But you meant by becoming a lawyer or an economist and marrying someone from Harvard. I'm not proud of myself. But I'm in this family too, and you can't keep giving me the silent treatment. There are a lot of things about me that aren't what you thought. But if you love me, you have to love all the things about me. And I love you. I'm sorry I let you down. I'm so sorry, Daddy. But you let me down too.
So, I mean, that is a really interesting kind of confrontation. And what that does, or what it did to me when I was trying to think grandly about, you know, how does one interpret this film politically? and it's a critique of American liberalism at that point in time. But it also, and centrist dad, because her dad is centrist dad, isn't it? Because, I mean, he's a nice guy. You know, he's a doctor. It's the first time in 6 years he's been on holiday, so he's hardworking. He's the one that saves Penny's life. He's the one that even goes back and looks after her to make sure she's fine, even though clearly he's not happy about what's happened. But, you know, he's got duty, professional ethics. He's a nice man. He loves his children. He wants the best for them, you know, all of that. And yet he's got a blind spot, which Baby exposes to him. But to sort of be fair to him, I mean, he kind of does ostracize her, but, and he doesn't like Johnny, but he's kind of off the hook in the sense that in terms of us being a bit critical of him, because he thinks Johnny has got Penny pregnant. He's led to believe that Penny is pregnant through Johnny. And then here's this Johnny trying to get off with his baby daughter. So he doesn't. So, and it's only when he finds out the truth that then he goes, oh, everything's fine. Yeah. So the kind of film has tried to have it a bit both ways. It tries to reveal the kind of what Perry Anderson might have called the antinomies of American liberalism. And yet it kind of gets American liberalism kind of off the hook. And that's, it's kind of interesting because, you know, it's a Hollywood film, so you might think, well, it's going to take the hard edges off. But it's interesting that it does reveal the class bias, most definitely the class bias, the gender issues within American liberalism. But what do you think about the end? Because it kind of exposes these contradictions and critiques them. But then the end, what do you think about the end?
I mean, it's the only way the film could end, really, given what it's there to do for girls who want to be Frances. You can't leave her heartbroken. But yeah, it does tie it up in a bit too neat of a bow with not just Frances and Johnny ending up together, not just it looking quite likely that Johnny's not going to lose his job, but is actually going to save Kellerman's, not just Robbie getting his comeuppance, not just the evil older woman who we haven't mentioned getting her comeuppance, but also the liberal dad learning his liberal lesson and accepting Johnny into his heart. In an hour and a half worth of film, we get a lot of happy ending.
Yeah, because listener, if you haven't seen the film, it kind of does end. There's like two endings. It ends. The first ending is when Johnny, you're not the person that stole the money, but you're the person that slept with Baby, one of the guest's daughters. So you got to go. So it kind of goes. Right, he goes, and you think that's the end. You think you're never going to see Johnny again. And Kellerman's has a last night for all the guests, where they all do their bits and they all have a sing song, and it's horrible actually. It's because you get Kellerman, who isn't, you know, in terms of his attitude to his employees, isn't very nice. His nephew isn't very nice, and all these people having a happy time, and all the guests are all happy. But then you've got all the employees, the dancers, and the rest of them are kind of at the back. In the dark, they're not really participating, and it's kind of interesting that it's a bit of a dark moment. But then Johnny comes back, and then he strides in and he goes up to the stage and he starts dancing with Baby, with Frances, who finally does the jump that she didn't do, and when they did the mambo in that other place, and so everything's consummated, and then literally. Everybody's dancing, you know, Kellerman's dancing, everybody's happy, the guests are dancing with all the employees, they're all mixing together, everything is happy. All the differences, so far as the audience is concerned, have all been reconciled to a great theme tune. So, you know, somebody would say, well, it's revealed all the class hostilities, but then it kind of, that's the end, you know, everybody's reconciled at the end through the medium of dance. Liberalism is critiqued. And then reinforced at the very end. But like you say, it's part of a genre. So you don't tend to have dark, unhappy endings in that kind of a genre. But the politics of it, you know, we're interesting in the critique, in the critique, but also in how it resolves it.
Yeah. I think the film is an optimistic film. And in some ways, the timing of that, you're setting it in the first half of 1963. You know, before, and the opening monologue from Baby says it was before Kennedy was shot. You know, that was a time that I think America was optimistic about itself. And I think at least in part, and liberal America was optimistic about itself. And I think by the 80s, liberal America was feeling a bit battered and a bit cynical and a bit bruised. And maybe what the author is explicitly trying to do is give liberal America back a little bit of its optimism. You know, you can change, you can critique and grow, you can grow beyond what you think you could be to what you could really truly be, go off and leap off a stage. No one puts Baby in a corner.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's a myth. I mean, you know, like all great films, it taps into a myth or a mythical idea of what the past was and how we can be and what the future may be. And it is very positive in the sense that, you know, Baby stands up. She stands up for somebody else. And everybody wins, you know, and that's an interesting point that she is standing up for Patrick Swayze. So the role reversal is really interesting. But as a kind of, you know, I'm a bit of a historian, and as a kind of a view of actual America at that point in time, it's bonkers because, of course, yeah, they're all dancing and they're all happy. And it's as if, well, when Kennedy gets it, then it all goes wrong. And that actually is another myth, because that's actually something that's behind JFK, about, you know, Oliver Stone's film, that everything was, it all went wrong when they killed JFK. And of course, it was all going wrong while JFK was president, you know, Vietnam, civil rights, and all. And instead of America all coming together under one dance, of course, you know, 1968, all the riots, all the other assassinations, and it all went to pot. So you might actually be right. You might have put your finger on something, that it's actually meant to be a film written by presumably a liberal in the dark days of the 1980s, kind of putting a positive spin on a period for which it was probably quite difficult, you know, historically, if you want to be historically accurate, to put on a positive spin for liberal America.
Mm, mm, absolutely. No, and I think that, and I think you're right. I don't think any girls like me who first saw it when we were tweens were explicitly thinking, oh my goodness, it's really important that women should have access to safe and legal abortion. but that was there in the background. And then we all grew up and actually we all referred and we all watched this film over and over again. And it is always there. And I think it has reinforced certain values in me, possibly more so than, you know, a much more explicitly political film would do.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's always the thing with a film like Dirty Dancing, or one that has, you know, millions of people have watched Dirty Dancing, you know, and, you know, there's a whole thing about it. But millions of people, and there's a message there, which maybe some of them will pick up, but if only a few of them do comparatively, that's still a hell of a lot of people. And like you say, maybe even if it's kind of on a subconscious level, background level, it's there for millions and millions and millions of people. Whereas a Ken Loach film, how many people watch a Ken Loach film? You know, it's battering them over the head with something they probably already realise anyway.
Yeah, and how many people watch a Ken Loach film that haven't already thought deeply about issues that Ken Loach is...
Yeah, that's absolutely...
Whereas you don't tune into Dirty Dancing to think about abortion rights. And of course, that's very, very timely at the moment. We are looking at a Supreme Court nomination in the US that could overturn Roe versus Wade. We could go back to lots and lots of women doing what Penny's had to do.
Yeah. And I wonder if, you know, I wonder nowadays, you know, if the American networks even show this film, or whether it would have to be, it could be shown, you know, in totally uncut. Nowadays, I think you're right when you were saying, you know, what kind of film aimed at this kind of an audience does this now? Well, as you suggested, not that many.
No. And I think, and in terms of the uncut, you can't cut the abortion out of the film. You just couldn't do it. You would never film left. And so whether it's shown or not, I couldn't tell you, but you certainly couldn't show a cut version that takes that out. Well, there you go. Dirty Dancing, one of the most political films of the 80s, something I've insisted on for a long time. And I think that we today can agree that that is true.
We certainly can. Thank you very much for making me watch that film.
Well, thank you very much for being open to do so. I think if I read a whole book about football, it was about time you did a film on dancing. Great. Well, thank you ever so much, Steve, and to our listeners for sticking with us. I hope you're all about to rush off now and at the very least put on the Dirty Dancing soundtrack. It just behoves me to say thank you to Lord Stuart Wood for our theme tune. If you've enjoyed this episode or any episodes of our podcast, please do rate and review us on iTunes. It does help people to find us. And this has been a Political Human production. Thank you very much.